Well, let me join Sanjeev and Hinak in welcoming everybody here. This Jelinek Memorial Workshop is actually different in an important respect, I think, from the workshops that Sanjeev reviewed at the beginning of the morning, in that it's dealing with meaning. So I don't think any of the previous workshops got all that close to semantics. The closest they got maybe was machine translation. All of those workshops kind of followed the tested IBM approach of putting a performance chart on the wall, which showed how you did better and better at predicting some known output, and you hope to increase that number over the summer. In this case, we don't know what the output ought to look like. Okay. That's the problem of meaning representations that a lot of this workshop is dealing with. And as a result, we're going to be spending the first week in the probabilistic representations of linguistic meaning workshop doing some blue sky thinking. And the real question here is, what should computational semantics look like in 10 years? So there's been an explosion of computational semantics at, for example, the ACL conference and other conferences in that orbit, like EMNLP and NACL and EACL. And Ben may have something to say about this when he takes the latter part of this talk. The work in this area is not so unified in that people are trying all different kinds of things, mostly in a setting where they first try to reduce to some task where you can measure performance and then measure performance on that. And this leads to a kind of fragmentation of effort where it's within some particular subcommunity that's trying to measure something like textual entailment, you're developing measures that may be, you're developing methods that may be able to push that performance metric up, but it's not clear whether they're going to help other people's tasks, and even within that area, the methods may not transfer. So we'd like to take a step back and understand where we might be trying to go, and I think part of what we'd like to do here is to incorporate more of what semanticists think about, I mean, people in linguistics departments. We like our notion of semantics to be integrated with other problems that are related to semantics, so reasoning and knowledge representation. This is a term due, I think, originally to Jerry Fodor, the language of thought, and a good working hypothesis is that natural language is structured in a way to reflect the conceptual categories and relationships and operations that we use when we do certain kinds of non-linguistic thinking as well. Whatever we say probably ought to be integrated with pragmatics. In fact, that's one reason to go probabilistic. And the probabilistic treatment that we're going to have in 10 years, I think, is going to be a more complete probabilistic specification of what's going on than most of the models that people are doing now to do, say, prediction of semantic role labels or prediction of textual entailment or prediction of hyponymy or whatever your task is. Okay. So why do we want to do a probabilistic treatment? And I think most of my slides will actually have this header, but with different subheaders. So the first reason is integration. There's a reason that logic has been the common substrate for semantics, knowledge representation, and reasoning. It's precisely the fact that it is common. So the basic picture that people have had for a while is that you have semantics, and those connect up with some model theoretic representation, something in logic. And semantics is the way that we connect this to that. And in comprehension and production, we're going in both directions. And so this involves some complicated logical form representation of the sentences, maybe derived from the syntax. But eventually what we're doing is trying to get into some knowledge base. And the reason that we want things to be in terms of logic is that's assumed to be how we do reasoning. So we can draw conclusions from sentences. But there's a problem with this story. So one question is, can we really fit sensations in? That ought to be part of our knowledge as well, things that we get non-linguistically. Can we really fit pragmatics in? That never really seemed to fit well with the logical reasoning picture, partly because what you're doing with pragmatic, the conclusions that you draw pragmatically almost seem to demand some kind of probabilistic or at least very context-dependent reasoning. But what we have on the right here has been moving away. So if you look at the rest of cognitive science, we now tend to think about what you know when you know stuff as being more probabilistic knowledge, and logical inference as being displaced by probabilistic inference, or if it's based off things you get from the outside world, statistical inference. There's sort of a nice story down here of what's going on with your knowledge as you observe things in the real world, and a purely logical view of sentences doesn't fit as nicely with the rest of the story about cognition as it used to. So that's the first reason. But this is going to be harder to model than just building, for example, Bayesian networks. The structures that we need to worry about semantically have to do with beliefs about the world, and in fact beliefs about other worlds that exist only in people's heads or in hypotheticals. So what's the probabilistic version of modal logic? How do we deal with beliefs that are richly structured and not just, as in Bayesian networks, some vector over a fixed number of random variables? What if we have beliefs which are incomplete, as in, say, situation semantics, or vague, or contradictory, or imprecise? So, in other words, should we really be starting with logic and just put probability distributions over possible worlds, or do we need more than that? So we may need some new ideas about probabilistic modeling. There's a lot of history, and I'm very happy to have been a part of it, in trying to turn linguistics into probabilistic models. I'll say more about that in a couple of slides. But I think semantics is really the next frontier for that, and we should really be thinking now about how we're going to move into that. Okay, so natural language, as I said, is kind of related to the language of thought, and here's a nice quote from a paper more than 20 years ago, a sentence that Fillmore is talking about here. He says, it didn't give you the information that you got out of it directly. You had to compute some of that information by constructing, in your imagination, a complete context within which each of the lexically signaled framings was motivated. So his notion here is really a kind of noisy channel model. I'll say that to keep the speech people happy, where you had some really complicated structure in your head, maybe with structures that have names in your language, and you're going to try to evoke a similar structure. You're going to try to compress this down by evoking a similar structure in the head of your listener. The sentence that Fillmore had in mind here, which he acknowledges is a ridiculous sentence, but it puts together a number of examples he's been talking about earlier in the paper. The decedent, while on land and in Mufti last weekend, ate a typical breakfast and read a novel high in flip strength. So who are we talking about here? Well, Mufti is civilian clothing, and so by contrast, we know that this is a person who would ordinarily be an official dressed in some kind of uniform, but is off duty here on the weekend. What kind of official? Well, he's on land. Land as opposed to sea, and so he's probably a naval officer. If we said he was on the ground, he would be an Air Force officer. Ground and land are different with respect to what they contrast to. The decedent means he's no longer alive, but at the time of this sentence, he apparently was. So we're talking about a now dead naval officer. This paper talks about the weekend and why it's called the weekend and distinguished from the week. So a Saturday and a Sunday. So what's a breakfast? Well, it's one of these things that's hard to define, but there are a few typical characteristics of a breakfast. That it's eaten in the morning, that it's eaten after a period of sleep, and that it contains certain typical ingredients. And any of those can be left out or changed, and it's still a breakfast. You'd still be capable of referring to it as a breakfast. In this context, and I'll let you think about why, this is referring to the ingredients and not when it's eaten or how much sleep he's had before. And somehow you manage to reconstruct this. As to flip strength, this is an example that Fillmore put in order to indicate just how much of a situation may be evoked by a particular term. I don't know if anybody who hasn't read this article knows what flip strength is. So Fillmore apparently came to learn that in the industry of pornographic novels, flip strength is a term that refers to how likely it is, if you're flipping through the book in a bookstore, that you'll find something fascinating and want to bring the book home. and a publisher might reject this novel that you've submitted for having too low a flip strength. You have to you have to spread the fascinating events more evenly through the novel, so that people who are flipping through will find it. So any of these things is evoking an entire frame, and we could give a more plebeian answer example here. If I talk about a door, it's hard to visualize a door without visualizing a wall and maybe a building that it's part of. So I think in order to talk about semantics, we're going to have to talk about these issues of what gets evoked by particular words. And we also want to make this compositional. So although I can ask questions about what happens in a car crash, I can also talk about particular kinds of car crashes. I'll give you a different example that Darcy and I have been talking about. So here's a nice word, which should evoke a situation. So I'm gonna tell you about a widow. So how old is a widow? Old, how old? Just pick a number. 50s. Well, that's an interesting question. I was thinking human widows because I have a distribution over what widows look like. And my distribution favors humans. Now, yours may not. So personally, I would say, you know, maybe 60s, 70s, 80s. And there's my distribution over widows also favors people who are alive currently. And so people who are alive aren't in their hundreds, typically. On the other hand, a widow is a person whose spouse is dead, and dead people tend to be old. And people tend to be about the same age as their spouse. And taking these into account, we might conclude that she's not that young, because her spouse is dead, therefore probably old, and therefore she probably is as well. Now, we can see that you're doing this kind of reasoning because if I use this within a compositional frame, if I talk about the widow of the firefighter, now how old is she? Ah, okay, well now, you know, dead firefighters might die younger because they're in a hazardous profession. Right? And as a result, we might think that she's young as well. And if we take the widow of the village chieftain, well, a village chieftain is also in a hazardous profession. So she's younger again for several reasons. The chieftain's also in a hazardous profession. Chieftains, and presumably also their widows, live in countries where the life expectancy is lower to begin with. And finally, a village chieftain may take younger wives, perhaps several of them. And so all of these figure into your distribution, and that you're flushing out an entire picture of what this person might be like. And this applies not only to widows, but also to car crashes and people who are eating breakfast. And it's hard for me to imagine a theory of semantics that doesn't involve these probability distributions over the world. So the second reason to look at a probabilistic treatment is it just seems to be the next frontier in computational linguistics, which is the community that I come out of. So for some decades, the project of computational linguistics has been, or a project, and I'm going to distinguish this from natural language processing, which has engineering goals to try to build things that work because they're useful to people. Here the idea is to do linguistics and answer the questions of linguistics and come up with linguistic theories, but theories that you can actually execute so that they work on real data. And that doesn't mean throwing away the insights of linguistics. In fact, it means incorporating them. So the idea has been going to go from grammatical formalisms to probabilistic formalisms, to go from what's possible to what's probable. And this is an enrichment of the theory. Historically, I think this really started with phonetics and collocations in speech recognition. So here I mean Gaussian mixture models and n-gram models. And this is the tradition that grew out of the speech group at IBM, headed by Fred, to infect natural language, partly due to work that was done here in things like part of speech tagging and machine translation. So, as I said, this started with phonetics, but moved into phonology, morphology, eventually historical linguistics, various models of word collocation, both local and global within a document, syntax, and translation with models of various kinds that are more or less linguistically plausible. And the idea in all of these is to model the joint distribution by elements of form, with one another and with elements of meaning. And having such distributions allows us to develop algorithms, typically statistical inference algorithms, which robustly do comprehension, production, and learning. And to the extent that you believe your model, these can be thought of as just-so stories about the way humans might solve the problem. At least they're what David Marr would have called a theory of the computation. In other words, they're describing what one ought to do, at least if the model is correct. And people are hard to distinguish from systems that do what they ought to do. People are really quite good. You generally lose money betting against humans. So the reason that this works well is that humans at least seem to act as if they know what those probabilities are. In other words, you can see in the psycholinguistic lab that people are sensitive to the frequencies of different constructions. And there was a nice paper by Steve Abney in 1995, which some of you have read, which tries to convince linguists of this fact. Not all linguists are convinced yet. But knowledge of language, I think it's taken outside of some corners of linguistics to include knowledge of probabilities. It's amazing that we can communicate so effectively at such high bandwidth, and this seems to require some kind of prior probability to reconstruct the parts that are left out. This certainly seems to be true for syntax, where if you just use a grammar-based formalism, there are hundreds of thousands of interpretations of an ordinary sentence of length, say, 23 words, which is the average for the Wall Street Journal. All of these rare constructions, which are necessary for one or another corner case, start to interact and give you crazy interpretations of the sentence that you're observing, unless you have some way of distinguishing what's common from what's uncommon. And it seems like this is also necessary for understanding what I'm trying to get across to you when I give you a vague or incomplete sentence. So models over time get richer in linguistic insight. The goal of science in general is to find the underlying probability distributions that can explain our observations and predict observations that we haven't seen. Sorry, I shouldn't call them observations if we haven't seen them yet. So explain and predict, observations and predict held out observations. And the progress of science consists of making better and better models. This is E.T. James, who was a unabashed Bayesian and has this lovely book, Probability Theory, The Logic of Science, that was published posthumously, which makes this case in a way that you kind of want to read something out loud to the person next to you from every page. So linguists shouldn't be alarmed by this. As the Sermon on the Mount says, do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've come not to abolish them, but to fulfill them. So it's well known that Chomsky is resistant to being fulfilled in this particular way. I don't think he's likely to have a conversion experience where he takes probability to be a fulfillment, but he's wrong about this, I think. Probability doesn't subtract from a model. Rather, if you take away probability, you've subtracted from the model by making it merely Boolean. There is a sense in which Chomsky is right about this, which is that we are only human, so it does take time to fulfill the promise of linguistics. And generally, probabilistic models tend to start much simpler than what people have come up with in linguistics, which I think is really Chomsky's objection, because he still tends to argue against n-gram models. N-gram models are very helpful if you have a lot of data. They're very expressive. They're just not explanatory in that you need a lot of data in order to train them well. But starting with something simple is useful, and that may be our project this week. So a case study, which has been very successful, if we were starting with probabilistic syntax, say if we were doing this workshop 20 years ago, we might have people in the room who are coming from many different viewpoints about what a real linguistic theory should look like or what it should be able to accomplish for us, say in the psychology lab or as a matter of engineering. But we might have been able to agree that PCFGs, probabilistic context free grammars, would be a good place to start. All this formalism is really trying to do is to capture the most important things about syntax, which are that you have different types of phrases and that the phrases are structured hierarchically. And there's not much more to it than that. That leaves out a lot. Because it makes no commitment to what the non-terminals ought to be, or what the rules ought to look like, or what a collection of rules, a grammar, ought to look like. It doesn't tell you anything about, you know, non-terminals having feature structure or anything like that. It's a simple compositional mechanism. But within that, you can build other theories. So linguists talk about explanatory adequacy, meaning if you just have this theory, does it assign high probability to the languages that you actually see in contrast to the languages that you don't see? In other words, does this have a sufficiently strong inductive bias if you have little training data? Well, no, it's missing a lot of things that probably belong in universal grammar. It doesn't say that languages have verbs. It doesn't say that those verbs have subcategorization frames. It doesn't talk about movement. It doesn't talk about selectional preference. It doesn't talk about subjacency. But if you want, you can specialize this theory by adding priors over grammars or by restricting the structure. Linguists also talk about descriptive adequacy, which mean that the theory is expressive enough. So PCFGs are expressive enough, maybe. We don't worry so much about explanatory adequacy if you have lots of training data, which clearly we don't for semantics. PCFGs, you might take issue with the descriptive adequacy. Are natural languages really context-free? There's arguments that they're not quite. But the formal treatments that we've been able to get, analysis of these probability distributions and the algorithms for doing production comprehension and learning with these probability distributions, those results extend to more complicated variants like tree adjoining grammars, categorical grammars, HPSG, things that people are looking at now where the non-terminals exist in a continuous space. It's hard to imagine how we could have done any of this work without doing it first for PCFGs. This is not the only example I could have given. So another example is optimality theory. Optimality theory is substantively very weak. It doesn't tell you, it's a theory, the subtitle of the optimality theory book is a theory of constraint interaction in generative grammar. It's only a theory of constraint interaction and not what the constraints look like. And it's easy to write down very trivial grammars in optimality theory. So we can have a constraint that says the output agrees with the predictions of Chomsky and Halley's sound patterns of English. And another constraint that says your prediction agrees with sound pattern of Russian. And now you do get a factorial typology, and that if you re-rank these constraints, if English comes first, you get English. If Russian comes first, you get Russian. You've predicted the languages that actually exist. The problem is that nobody believes that this is the real theory of what the constraints might look like. All this is trying to describe is the interaction among constraints, and to get a real theory of universal grammar, you have to specialize this down. But at least this makes this flexible, and this was an easy enough to understand formalism that the phonology community went wild for it, and within a few years it completely transformed what was going on in the phonology community, because everybody was trying to explain what they did within phonology within this framework. So the best that we could hope for from this workshop is if we could come up with at least a common language that people could use to talk about probabilistic semantics, where they might not agree with it, but at least if they disagree with it, they could use this as their baseline and explain how what they're doing contrasts with it. So what should we capture initially in a theory like this? What are the basic kinds of objects that we're dealing with? What is it? Where do probability distributions fit in? What are these distributions over? Which things might be non-probabilistic? How do they fit together? And what I should have said here is also what's left that doesn't fit into this theory that we recognize still has to be worked out. There are things that we might not handle right away that are very important. Things like a theory of verb aspect. So event semantics shows up across, I think, all the languages of the world. Or physical predicates, which show up across all the languages of the world and have much in common. But we should at least give enough of a theory that there's somewhere to fit these things in. So the third reason to do a probabilistic treatment is that a lot of what's going on in language seems to make almost overt reference to probability distributions. So not only are we being probabilistic, as we are in, say, syntax, where when you say something, I understand that there are two possible meanings, and that's why I say that there's a misunderstanding, or I say that there's a pun. I recognize that there are different ways of interpreting a sentence. There are many sentences in natural language where in the semantics we're actually making overt reference by means of some linguistic construction to the fact that something's probabilistic. So here we have the word probably being used overtly within a sentence. So each of these sentences, and it didn't take me very long to make this slide, I think this is the quickest slide to make, because it's very easy to come up with examples like this. Each of these, I think, has multiple things going on. So you're probably going to lose now. So this is a probability distribution over some possible futures in a chess game. But it's doing something a little bit more interesting than just a distribution over probable futures, because it has this because clause. And so it's indicating not just possible futures of this chess game, over which there's some distribution given how I think you and your opponent might play, but also that distribution is somehow being warped by paying particular attention to a feature of the board and saying even if we changed other things about the board, and it's not clear which ones, this statement would still hold to some degree. Here's what's called an epistemic modal. She may have left, or she must have left. And the second sentence is providing discourse support for that. Sort of because her car is gone, we draw a particular conclusion. But why we're drawing, you know, under what does it mean for this sentence to be true? That she may have left or she must have left. If somebody were going to object to this in a discourse, on what grounds might they object? How is it that we negotiate things that we disagree about? So Drew and I have been looking at a particular case where two area chairs in a conference are trying to come to some conclusion about a paper assignment. One of the area chairs might be a computer. And if they disagree, they might disagree because they have different values about what's good. They might disagree because they disagree about their knowledge. And in that case, they need to engage in some kind of discourse to bring their knowledge into alignment. If you and I disagree, it might be because you know things that I don't, or because I know things that you don't. And it's not clear ahead of time which is true. And so we have to come up with some reasons for believing that she left or that she didn't leave. And providing this kind of support is a first move in such a discourse where we negotiate to try to bring our probability distributions into agreement. So I should cancel the milk. This is an example from one of James's papers. So in order to understand what it means for milk to be cancelable, you have to understand that this milk here, that what you can cancel is some event. And you have to understand how milk plays a role in different kinds of events, and which kind of event is likely simultaneously to be an event involving milk, or an event which could be described metonymically as the milk, and something which is cancelable, which you might like to cancel, which you have the power to cancel. And then this word should is also interesting. So this is another modal. So this is describing the traditional example, the traditional account of this kind of modal is that there's some set of worlds in which you are happy or you do what you're legal, you do what you should have done, and in those worlds you tend to have canceled the milk. But this notion of accessible worlds, worlds where you do what you should have done. Worlds which are consistent with your knowledge has always seemed like a placeholder, even to people like Lewis and Stalnacher who proposed it. It's not clear what the set of worlds is that you're looking at, and maybe what we need is a kind of probability distribution over worlds. Now, when I say something like this, it's not clear what my distribution is. There's a level of linguistic ambiguity, understanding what I mean, as well as a level of ambiguity, even once I know what I mean, I'm expressing that ambiguity when I say may have rather than must have or probably has. So here's an example where this kind of linguistic ambiguity shows up, the sign on the elevator that says children must be carried, and I think if I don't have a kid, I'm not allowed to get on the escalator. Because, you know, children must be carried, in order for you to step on the escalator. Okay, that's probably not what it means. There's another reading where it means in situations where you have a child and you get on the escalator with that child, the child must be carried. But the fact that you're restricting to that set of situations is being left implicit. And there's some kind of reasoning about the world and about the intention of the speaker, a kind of noisy channel model, maybe, where you're trying to reconstruct the set of situations that the speaker is talking about. Here's another example. Most parent, which has, I think, three things going on. So most parents, so we have a distribution over parents or typical parents, this is a generic or close to it, are likelier, so we have a probability, to give in on weekends. So we're restricting the situations to weekends, but not just weekends, weekends in which their role as a parent is being exercised by their child who is testing them by begging in some way. And their likelihood of giving in if that begging situation happens on a weekend is higher for most parents than if it were on a weekday. So this is a very complicated sentence that we have very little trouble in understanding. And there's going to be some story about nested probability distributions in order to just describe the meaning of this sentence. And to be able to figure out, there's a distribution over possible meanings when I utter this sentence. So what kinds of situations am I talking about? What's the meaning? But within the meaning, there's also nested probability distributions. Here we have an example of vagueness. If you can afford a cheap car, you can afford expensive coffee, because expensive coffee is still less expensive than a cheap car in absolute terms. So this is relative to the type car, the type coffee. I think this is an example that Dan sent in our email list. I gussied it up a little bit to point out that we also have this notion of can afford. So again, another modal. And this notion, this impersonal pronoun you or one, if one can afford a cheap car, which means this is generic over people in general, that doesn't mean it doesn't admit of exceptions, because there are some people who can afford cars more cheaply than coffee. Because you know they work for the car company and they get free leases on cars or something like that. And here's a counterfactual. So I think counterfactuals are really quite fascinating. This is asking what would have happened if you change what would have happened if you change a particular feature of the situation. So I poured the coffee, it spilled. What would have happened if you had poured the coffee? And I claim that in that case it wouldn't have spilled. So what am I imagining changed in that setting? And what is it that I'm trying to signal to you pragmatically? It might have been, you should listen to me next time. So if I told you to pour the coffee, that's probably what it is. You should listen to me. You should recognize that I'm clumsy and I wasn't just asking you to pour the coffee in order to save myself work. I was doing it in order to avert catastrophe. So next time, listen to me. Or I might mean something totally different, depending on what the context is. And figuring that out is difficult. Okay, so here's the participants. We have a terrific group of people here on the theory that if you get smart people in a room and have them argue, interesting things will happen. So these are people from a number of different fields, and I think what we're going to have to start to do is to align our different perspectives. So these names will come up again when I show you the agenda in a minute. We also have a lot of people who loved the idea, really wanted to be here, had conflicts. Many of those people were interested enough that they asked to continue to be involved in some way, to be involved in future events, to stay on the mailing list. And so here's a list of people who I really wish could have been here, but who've asked to be here virtually from psychology, linguistics, philosophy, and computer science. A couple of them are showing up, but a week late. So our agenda is we're going to start with some introductions and talk about the role of probabilities and the role of data the kinds of things that actually happen in the world. So we're going to start out by taking stock, the kinds of examples that we want to look at, how we're going to spend the week, what we think we already understand. We're going to start out at a high level with language of thought, and we have a couple of talks here about a type theoretic approach that might shed some light on this, and a plenary talk on the kinds of tasks that we might want to solve that involve question answering about science exams. So this is primarily reasoning about situations with generics, given some kind of knowledge representation. And so we're going to talk about those things in these discussion sessions. So everybody, I think, will come to the plenary talks, and people are welcome to come to any of these discussion sessions that pique their interest. We'll move on to pragmatics on Wednesday with a plenary talk by Dan and a discussion about pragmatics and game theory and how this fits in with probability distributions. Toward the end of the week, we're going to start moving into how this connects to NLP. So David's going to talk about the problem of reference, particularly identifying what events are being talked about in text. And we're going to talk about how things get referred to in text, how they get framed, and how different things get marked linguistically, and how this connects up with the mental conceptualization. This leads into a discussion of grounding and perception, and Stefan Larsson is going to be giving a talk on Thursday morning, and we'll continue talking about this on Thursday afternoon. And then on Friday, the point is to start figuring out what we should be doing next as we work forward. So I've said this is trying to establish some kind of vision for 10 years, but that won't do anything if we can't figure out what should be done in the next year, what kind of tasks and data sets and future papers we think might actually take steps toward the eventual goal. So what might we be able to do, which is not just confined to this week, both things that we should do on paper and things we should do actually building stuff. And some people are going to be here for the next few weeks, so one question is what they should be doing. And Ben, who's going to talk next, is going to be kicking that off by this talk, so he's going to be leading the remaining 3 weeks of the prelim workshop. I think this first week is also going to help the team that's working on annotation of semantic forms for machine translation by giving them a broader sense of what it is that you're trying to preserve as you translate from one language to another. So the goals here are, again, just to summarize of this week, are what are the constraints on a full theory? And I think because we come from different fields, we're going to just have to spend some time arguing and listening closely to one another. Can we agree on some kind of baseline theory, or at least figure out what's not going to work? And what do we still need to do on paper and when building stuff? Okay, so we may not have a lot of time for questions before I hand off to Ben. Do you want me to hand off to Ben first?
Let's do that. Ben,
why don't
you set up a new consideration?
Sounds good.
Okay. So for the next couple of weeks, I'm just going to skim through this real fast so we can make up some time. We're going to be much less blue sky. So this is... This is going to be a smaller exploratory effort on trying to look back at a couple of decisions that have been made in the CS community on its treatment of thematic roles. So theta roles in linguistics were eventually ported to this label semantic roles, where generally we understand that verbs tend to encode some basic set of meanings of the basic who's, the what's, and the where's. And the theta roles are sort of stapling tags on the participants of these events, to say these are the sorts of roles that they play in these event descriptions. And it could be we mean something very specific, something very Fillmore-esque, like this is the driver versus the passenger, or we can be talking about something more abstract, like agents and patients that are meant to generalize across a larger swath of verb frames. So there's been plenty of labeled resources. These are just four that are somewhat this summer specific, especially the last three. But I'm going to jump into PropBank, where PropBank, we take sentences out of the Penn Tree Bank. So these are primarily sentences out of the Wall Street Journal. We have a syntactic analysis that was done by hand, and then we jump in and start pointing at particular noun phrases and say, this particular noun phrase plays a particular argument role that's specific to this particular sense of this particular verb. And they annotate a big swath of data to try to give us statistics, actual usage statistics, at least with respect to the Wall Street Journal. So at the bottom, we have some hit, and we have a particular sense of the word hit, such that arg0 is something of the agent type role, and so on, arg1, arg2. and there's other data that's been annotated with a similar schema. All right, there's a lot of different reasons why we're interested in the task that I'm about to describe. One of them is this question about what if we want to move into a new language. So if I want to create prop bank for a new language, can I just sit down and start labeling sentences with argument labels? Well, probably not, at least 12 years ago. The AMR team may have something different to say by the end of the summer, but at least, so Dan Gilday, who's here, and Martha Palmer, who will be here I believe, next week or towards the end of this week, who came up with PropBank, they wrote a paper, and there were a couple of papers that came afterwards that sort of rediscovered the same thing, that syntax, having access to the underlying syntax of a sentence is pretty critical in trying to understand, trying to automatically predict what the semantic roles are in a given sentence. So if I want to start labeling these semantic roles for new languages, it would seem, at least based on the history of the CS field, I first need to work my way up the NLP pipeline. I need to get up to the level of having manually created syntactic trees, and on that I can then start labeling the semantics. Now this sounds very expensive, and indeed it is. There was a DoD-funded project called Antinotes that tried to push this out for Chinese and Arabic, and there were a number of versions of this, but it came at great cost. If we want to start labeling thousands of languages, this is not at all scalable. So this motivated a project a few of us worked on last summer, and this is building heavily on a long arc of work by Jason on maybe we can just skip the tree banking, where if we have access to a downstream labeling, if I only have access to semantic roles, can I treat the rest of the NLP pipeline as latent and sort of marginalize everything else out? And what we found is that we could actually do this reasonably well for a number of languages, everything that's in the Connell 09 dataset. And we also found, and this is the result that I'm actually more happy about, that having access to downstream semantic roles allows you to do much better in syntactic grammar induction than had been reported in other places. So this is no longer fully unsupervised grammar induction because you do have this annotation. But the motivation for this project was this idea that it seems like it'd be a lot easier for a normal person, a non-linguist, to be able to do basic semantic annotation than it is to have to manually create a syntactic tree bank. And so if we can do a pretty decent job of inducing syntax based on the semantics, then maybe we should just skip tree banking in the future and just start labeling semantics instead. That the wonders of 21st century machine learning means that we can sort of induce all the underlying structure to get us to this shallow semantic layer. So after that result, we said, great, let's start labeling a bunch of new languages. We went to Mechanical Turk, said, can you please label this data? This is a project we tried in the fall, and it was very hard. So by normal people, I consistently mean Turkers, and you can maybe disagree with that, but non-linguists. So no matter how we tried posing this task, it didn't work out very well, and it was all based on a prop bank style annotation of could you please label this with arg0, arg1, and so on. So it could be that we're just not very good at this. Martha certainly has a lot more experience at it than I do, maybe I should have gone and talked to her about it, or maybe we were asking the wrong questions. So AMR is one way we can interpret this, maybe we were asking the wrong questions. AMR is perhaps one solution to this. Instead, what we're going to be looking at is this more finer grained notion of the problem. And in particular, if we go back to this paper by Dowdy in the early 90s, and some of you know this paper very well, others of you have never heard of it. Before the 91 paper, there was this sort of raging argument amongst people that did theta roles, primarily in linguistics, to say, should we have 5 roles or 20 roles or 517 roles, where we're still talking about all these very discrete categorical labels, and is there really such a thing as a benefactive role, yes or no? And this is going to give rise to a lot of papers, and people will argue back and forth. So Dowdy jumped into this and said, hold on, wait a minute. What is it that we're trying to do in the first place? It seems like these theta roles in general are just these abstractions that serve some useful utility when we're trying to describe syntactic transformations, but the actual semantic properties seem to devolve down into these more core binary predications. There's these very simple questions that we can ask about a given sentence, and if we look at the patterning of the answers to these questions, it seems that they tend to cohere, that the answers to some questions tend to drift into sort of subjecthood, at the syntactic level, which is what we might call agent, why a lot of people at the time would call this is the agent because it has certain properties, and this is the patient because it has certain other properties, and agents tend to be subject, and these proto-agents tend to be subjects, these proto-patients tend to be objects. The way many people interpreted this paper It seems, at least based on the literature, they said, there is such a thing as an agent, there is such a thing as a patient, so let's move on and start labeling things as agent-patient. We're going to go back and just start doing this binary labeling task to see if we get something different. So some of the sorts of questions we're talking about from the original Dowdy paper are, if I point at a participant that's described in a sentence, and I say, did this participant change state as a result of the event, yes or no? Did they change location, yes or no? And so on and so forth. And then we're going to try to predict these things downstream. There's been some more recent work by Scott Grimm at Rochester that sort of more fully fleshes this out. Dowdy was only looking at very simple transitive sentences, only in English, only declarative. And so there's been more theoretical work on trying to blow that out. On the psycholinguistic side, there's a few papers by Keiko that who basically says, Dowdy was sitting in an armchair and he had these five sentences, do normal people actually do this? Where here, normal people means undergraduates. And he says, okay, for these synthetic sentences that I come up with, can I get labels for these various Dowdy questions that correspond to what Dowdy was claiming should be true? And sure enough, you do, that these undergrads were able to basically label these sentences at the type level with properties that sort of conform to what Dowdy was claiming. So then what do we want to do? We want to extend the same sort of Keiko-like experiment, but move from the type level to the token level, by which we mean, rather than saying for a given verb where we have a single, say, synthetic sentence, like in the FrameNet scenario, we want to label for this one verb, for this one sentence, the strict lexical entailments of this verb always means that the agent always has the following properties and the patient always has the following properties. Instead, we want to go sentence by sentence, a number of different sentences for the same verb, and ask all these different questions to see if, in some cases, you get, say, a causal bit is flipped yes, and in other cases, the causal bit is flipped no. But in all cases, people would agree that this does seem to be arg zero, or the agent-ish sort of role. So generally, we want to basically take prop bank-like data sets and convert them to semantic bits. So we're referring to this project as the binary SRL project. And then rather than just bits on the individual sentences, we're actually going to be using a Likert scale to see if we can get any traction on this notion of sort of expectations, a sort of soft expectation on these binary properties. So the main difference between the verb kill and murder is that murder has a strict lexical entailment of intent on the agent. So I can't say John murdered Bill accidentally. You can't say that. But I can say that John killed Bill accidentally versus John killed Bill with a knife. So intent is not strictly set by the verb in this case. But if I just say John killed Bill and I ask you, how likely do you think it is that John intended to perform that action? That's not going to be, I don't know. There is going to be a certain background knowledge that comes to play. And you're going to say, well, usually it seems to be that he probably had intent. So we want to see if we can get actually any real traction on this. Can we at least get reasonable agreement across annotators that these scores seem to drift away from 50-50 for cases where there isn't a strict lexical entailment? So this is a particular one version of the HIT. We've been working on this for a few months as a sort of slow burn background project by the various people involved. There's now a new version of this interface that we put up last week starting to collect data, and we're hoping that we'll have the first data set by next week when everyone shows up. So this month, the two main goals is human experiments and predictive model. Human experiments, we want to fine-tune this question set. This is a very tricky problem. Like I said, in the fall, it consistently failed each time I tried to roll it out. This seems to be working a little bit better, but we still think there's some fine-tuning on getting the questions just right. And then the main result that we would hope for, probably more than anything for this workshop, is if we can get a fair number of token-level labels for a fair number of verbs that sort of conforms to the Keiko experiment at the type level, but now on a larger data set. And talking to some linguists like Grimm, there's some people that are very excited about the possibility of generating this data and pushing it out more in the linguistic community. And then more applied, since this is a CLSP workshop, we have a model for prop bank, and we're porting that over the next few weeks to try to do this binary prediction task to see how well we can do. Generally, there's a lot of questions that this brings up. So with respect to the rest of the groups, question five is how does this relate to the work that's already being done in AMR, the Prague Dependency Tree Bank, VerbNet, and then VerbCorner is a project by Martha that's not part of this summer workshop, but she's involved with, that's asking similar sorts of questions, but when we've gone back and forth on this, our intuitions on what we're trying to do seem to diverge, and so I'm looking forward to be able to go back and forth with her more this month, and maybe that data will actually help inform us. Most of the rest of this other stuff, and then point six, which I'm not going to talk about in any really great detail, but yet another way to view what this task is trying to do is say that with all the movement lately towards having more vector-based representation of lexical semantics, it could be that this is sort of taking the sort of supervised approach of walking our way to a vector-based representation, whereas the majority of work in the community is this unsupervised dimensionality reduction of large corpora into some other sort of vector representation. So it could be that there's somewhere in between, that these questions that we're trying to label are the sort of canonical dimensions that that people are trying to induce automatically, or I could just be blowing smoke and there's no relationship either way. But so that's it. I can take questions.